No longer would Krieg's fortitude be enough to win the day. When gods and monsters clashed above our heads, what did our efforts matter in the least? What difference could our tiny, fragile lives possibly make? And who would even care to remember that we tried? The galaxy-spanning empire that would exist in the wake of the Emperor of Mankind's Great Crusade would stand for 10,000 years. It would endure the worst horrors imaginable, innumerable, and often that sprung from the minds and spirits of humanity itself. In M41, it continues to stand as it has done for thousands of years, upon a precipice, a knife edge where every world, every battle, and every life has meaning, even those who appear to have died for nothing. Throughout those 10,000 years since the Emperor was interred upon the Golden Throne and the Astartes legions had turned upon one another, the aftermath of this was, with no pun intended, chaotic. There were many cults and religious factions surrounding the Emperor of Mankind and how he was beginning to emerge as this divine figure. Some of these were genuine and of the faithful, others were power-mad conspirators and those who would seek to exploit the weak minds of men, even those who would seek the dark corruption and promises from beyond the veil. The Temple of the Savior Emperor was one of the many cults which grew up around the worship of the Emperor. This had followed the exponential growth of followers among the Imperial citizenry who began to view him as a god after the Horus Heresy. The Temple would become the dominant religious institution in the Imperium by M32, until later in M36 when the Age of Apostasy would see it reformed, and those who considered themselves under its banner were now reclassified as heretics. The new Imperial cult would be all that remained. One of its core reformations was to reduce the gross waste of material the previous Imperial cult had become known for in this era of decadence and greed. Critically, the religious department of the Imperium, the Ministerium, or the Ecclesiarchy was no longer allowed to form any kind of standing army, specifically no men at arms, militia, or navy assets. The idea was to prevent anybody with delusions of grandeur or ideas above their station creating another huge religious war within the Imperium, as was seen during the apostasy. This was, of course, where the loophole of the Sororitas would begin, becoming the military wing of the Ecclesiarchy, somewhat unofficially, because they did not violate the letter of the prohibition against men at arms. Despite the Imperium facing alien horrors which would consume entire worlds or burn them to sterile ash with gorse weaponry, one of the most terrible and ever-present threats remains its own population. Hive worlds contain many billions, if not tens of billions, of citizens. They often are industrial centres designed to output vast quantities of fabricated materials which are both important for systems nearby or broader continued war efforts. They may produce specific chemicals which are vital in plans that they couldn't begin to quantify, or they may produce military hardware for shipment off-world. Sometimes the very population itself is the most valuable commodity. However, there remains an extreme danger upon any such world. The vast populations for Imperial Hive Worlds are not necessarily uneducated, but they're not versed in the more nuanced power struggles and structures of the Imperium. They are very heavily indoctrinated by Imperial propaganda and the teachings of the religious institutions of the Ecclesiarchy. In fact, very much like, as was seen in human history, it is the religious section of the Imperium which tends to educate the population the most. And most citizens upon Hive Worlds really have no idea then what is occurring outside their own world, or even upon their own planet for that matter. The only information available is usually hearsay, sixth-hand stories of traders, or official Imperial dispatches. In some respects, this is beneficial because it maintains a level of calm and simplicity to their daily life. They don't need to know that one system over, Tyranids came through and exterminated all life. That's just going to be a stress that nobody needs. It prevents the population also from wanting to branch out, desire too much beyond their day-to-day when they see that the nearby system has a planet which is doing a lot better than they are. And above all else, of course, faith is everything. Trust in the Emperor, serve him, and so on. On the other hand, if a powerful individual should decide to coerce the population into believing that outside forces have turned against them and the Imperium, and that now it is they alone who must take up arms, that it is their very duty to launch a religious crusade upon nearby worlds, then who among a populace would seek to question or to challenge such orders? Or more realistically, the practical ability to indeed make any difference. Likely even those who did think better of it would have still no choice but to go along with what seemed certainly suspicious, questionable, perhaps even traitorous. Planetary governors, rogue psychers, manipulated religious officials, noble families, even influential guild masters may seek to overthrow imperial rule to secure more personal dominion. All of these are the beginnings of the collapse of a planet. The labyrinthine social structures, the cutthroat politics of imperial worlds, are in fact so unregulated that it may easily allow individuals or factions to rise to power through manipulation, deceit, and violence. And unfortunately, that is just the Imperium. Running a galaxy of worlds is quite difficult, and really you cannot get down to a granular detail of control in any meaningful way, because even if you did, it would still get distorted by corruption. For as horrifying as the Imperium is, they do try to rule things with a moderately hands-off approach. So long as a world is producing and outputting what it needs to, then they're pretty happy. But as we see in this story, they do keep a close eye on just who is managing a world and what they are up to. And for good reason. There will always be those who wish to exploit their positions of authority. They will gather followers, enforce loyalty through fear or bribery, and quietly undermine the Imperium's standing mandates. They'll understand their own world, and they'll intuitively know how to appeal to the downtrodden masses therein. The facts of any situation would not be relevant. They will just tell the uneducated masses whatever it is they need to hear to achieve whatever it is they seek. Because they know that in reality, even with whatever changes they seek, very little about ordinary citizens' lives will likely improve or change in any meaningful way. It is all the regular fare. Liberation from oppressive taxation, starvation and labour conditions, maybe a crusade against a persecuted minority to just satisfy the most zealous among the populace. Seeing the rise of such a rogue figure of power upon a world will create political instability by design. Often this will lead to widespread unrest or just outright rebellion, because it then enables that figure to point to the disruption as evidence of the enemy within that they seek to eradicate. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways, and the end result can be civil war, which then threatens not only planetary productivity, but also the overall strategic importance of these worlds to the Imperium's greater war machine. But of course, sometimes a population may just fully agree with an authority figure's proposal. They may simply have no working concept of just what kind of empire the Imperium of Mankind represents. Because remember, from the individual perspective, looking up at the skies of your world, what is the Imperium? What are the Emperor's angels? Their stories, myths even. These are things you've never seen, that nobody you know in generations has ever had any comprehension of. All the Imperium is to you is this ambiguous body who requires, demands, service, tithes. And for what? You never see any benefit, your world never improves, it's very likely the opposite. And this ignorance has led on multiple occasions for worlds to decide that they're just better off without the Imperium. And why not? Why can't they self-determine the way they want to go? They don't foresee their world as particularly important, surely they will not be missed. In some instances, that may be true, for a time at least, until a member of the Administratum recalls that a world has not received an audit in centuries, and their time is due. Other worlds have seen members of the nobility fight off-world, then discover exactly what the Imperium is all about, and for those reasons decide that maybe they will try to seek a different path. On planets like Krieg and Rophanon, both of these scenarios occurred, yet many more uncounted worlds have followed their same mistakes. Entire populations have risen against Imperial authority, seeking independence from its brutality or from deeply ingrained resentment toward the Imperium's unyielding demands. From the perspective of those upon a world, they're just one world. What difference could it possibly make? From the Imperial perspective, these uprisings can be catastrophic because they disrupt supply chains, require a significant redirection of military resources to resolve, and they can weaken humanity's defences against the more significant external threats. Then, of course, there is the possibility of the outbreak of rogue psykers if a world is not managed correctly by the Imperium, and that is a whole other problem in and of itself. In the infamous case of Krieg, the rebellion resulted in a devastating civil war, which only ended with the world's nuclear devastation and re-subjugation. Their story of betrayal remains a well-known cautionary tale of what happens when a world's population turns against the Emperor, although in the case of Krieg, it also saw the Imperium do what it does best, which is fight on with absolutely zero compromises until a world is crushed and brought back under the control of the Imperium. In the case of Rophanon, see my Rophanon video, although a less well-known world, it also underscores how rebellion can destabilize entire sectors, requiring costly campaigns to restore order. For the soldiers of Krieg, they understood all too well what is at stake when a world turns from the Imperium, and just as they had razed their own planet, seeing it stand as nothing more than an ashen wasteland in the shadow of nuclear apocalypse, the Death Corps would not hesitate to repeat such actions on any world they deemed unsalvageable. Better that than to allow the contamination to spread. Because one of the most insidious aspects of any uprising is their potential to inspire wider discontent. Should even a single uprising, power grab, or cult infestation prove successful, then there stands a possibility that the news of such a victory could spread, and this would encourage other worlds to then defy Imperial authority. One of the most dangerous planetary designations to fall, if corrupted though, are shrine worlds. And for several reasons, shrine worlds are usually sites of religious significance, so their fall can shatter morale across entire sectors. They can damage the faith that binds the Imperium together. Moreover, they often will contain vast numbers of not merely the faithful, but also the zealous. Individuals entirely blinded by devotion, to the point that they're unable to see anything beyond the words of their leadership. Worse still, some kind of powerful figure among the Imperial cult, a high-ranking member even of the Ecclesiarchy. The world of Vrax was in many ways a perfect storm. It was the very worst possible scenario for the Imperium to face, for not only was it a heavily reinforced Imperial armory world, but also the site of a popular Imperial cult shrine to Saint Leonis the Blind, an Ecclesiarchy missionary who had been martyred in the 38th millennium. So what a complete disaster it would be should such a world fall to the twisted falsehoods of a corrupt traitor or heretic. Any ensuing battle to reclaim such a world would be apocalyptic. The Vrax planetary system contained four worlds: Vrax Prime, Secundus, Tertius, and Uryx. Vrax Prime being the only world within that system which was inhabited. It was a Munitorum armor world, an administratum facility, essentially a storage planet. It contained supplies for the Imperial Guard or other assets that had been mothballed, only needed by reserves or during emergency shortages. Because of its relatively unimportant status, it contained a fairly small population by the standards of imperial worlds of an estimated 8 million citizens. These were mostly workers, but there was a decently sized garrison of troops and a planetary militia, otherwise known as the Planetary Defense Force. Despite its unassuming purpose, Vrax saw a transitory population of religious pilgrims who came to the planet to visit the Shrine of St. Leonis, and these numbered anywhere between 1 and 5 million at any given time. There would also be periodically large Imperial Guard forces who arrived to restock or upgrade their equipment before moving onward. A substantial barracks existed for this purpose within the starport upon the world. Vrax stood northwest of the Eye of Terror and formed a key world in the eyes of the Imperium for the potential defence against any incursions by chaotic forces. Whether those who existed on Vrax had any awareness of this is another matter entirely. This, though, is its primary function as an armory world for the Imperial Guard to draw from in the eventuality of a major regional campaign. But this is in fact common throughout the Imperium, and while it obviously creates problems of its own potentially, it's far easier to move ships containing masses of Imperial Guard who can then bolster a standing defense force than it would be to ship vast quantities of material around, because that in itself risks being compromised in some way while en route. Obviously, to protect against the raids that are commonly seen on Imperial worlds by Xenos, Renegades or Pirates, any armory world needs to be significantly reinforced. By design, it must be able to withstand an enemy assault upon it, without the need for off-world reinforcement for a good period of time. Upon Vrax, this fortified centre is known simply as the Citadel. This would become the fortress headquarters of the planet and contain the leadership of the guard forces and PDF. It was also the site of the administratum offices, the archives, and of course the Basilica of St. Leonis. It contained additional ecclesiarchy chambers, garrison barracks, Arbites HQ, and so on. Designed for defence, the Citadel was also equipped with formidable laser batteries, also which were operated from the Citadel. And as is typical for a bastion or armory world, these fortresses will be steadily upgraded over many centuries, or even over thousands of years. In the case of Vrax, the Citadel had been similarly improved to the point that the Munitorum regarded this armory as being all but impregnable. Its walls were shielded by void shield generators, making it all but invulnerable to longer range attacks, even that of Titanic scale war machines. Its defense laser batteries meant that any orbital assault would be attempted only by those who welcomed their own destruction. Worse still, these were also designed to engage on the surface and were situated so as to provide interlocking fields of fire to the Citadel. Beyond this, the Citadel had also established multiple reinforced rings of trench bunker networks surrounding it, strong points, pre-ranged artillery positions which extended in the rings from the base of the Citadel. All of this was designed as primarily a deterrent, but if necessary, to ensure that no matter how committed an assault by the enemies of the Imperium, they would never be able to claim the prize of its resources without becoming locked into a grinding slaughter that would allow more than enough time for defensive reinforcements from the Imperium to arrive. This was not merely theoretical either. Vrax had already endured raids from renegades and pirates, even some uprisings within its populace. This isn't unusual for any Imperial world, just small-scale instigators were always something that the Arbites have to deal with from time to time. But in its 10,000 year history, Vrax had never fallen to the traitors, the raiders, or usurpers. Cardinal Zafan's arrival on Vrax was an expectantly formal and greatly celebrated occasion. A procession led by the Cardinal himself and his thousand-strong entourage proceeded along roads lined with the garrison guard as Zafan gave out blessings to throngs of worshippers and religious pilgrims who could not believe they were able to be present at such an occasion. After the various ceremonies at the starport, the introductions, the blessings, the readings, the gifts, and so on, the Cardinal himself travelled to the Shrine of St. Leonis the Blind to pay his respects and share his presence with the bones of the Imperial Saint, when all this pomp and circumstance was concluded, the Cardinal would retire to his private chambers to reflect on the day with his closest advisers. Few could even begin to foresee just how long the Cardinal would choose to remain here on Vrax. To the confusion of many, Cardinal Zafan was then rarely seen after this entry into seclusion. Soon after, Vrax Prime went silent. All astropathic communications ceased, and despite repeated efforts by the Administratum, they could not be re-established. The last known communication was received upon Cadia, but it made little sense and was marked down as a failed communication. This often happened with astropathic messages, many did not survive transmission through the warp. Many months later, the Departamento Munitorum began to grow in suspicion that something else was wrong upon Vrax. Routine messages were still going unanswered. Further investigations were required. Finally, the message received by Cadia was then forwarded to the Departamento offices upon Terra, where they were given a forensic analysis. The translated result of the communication was devastating. The master of the Departamento Munitorum recorded that the Imperial Armory world of Vrax had fallen. Cardinal Astral Borgia passed into the waiting protection of the God Emperor some 5 years prior to the current situation upon Vrax. He had been old beyond the understanding of most human experience, and despite his extreme age and the work required to sustain him by the Mechanicus Biologus, he had been a serving and effective member of the Ministerium. As such, his loss was mourned greatly. Bells were tolled through numerous subsectors, and although he had not travelled beyond his cardinal world for many years, the impression he had left upon so many worlds still endured. His passing, though, meant that a seat upon the Holy Synod was now available and vacant. The chosen replacement, one of his proteges, Zafan. He had risen through the ranks of the Ministerium through, yes, some merit, but also patronage. This was nothing unusual among those areas of the Imperium which enabled the many with wealth or contacts to flex their political muscle. To say that Zafan had been installed would be too strong, but certainly he had been well positioned and recommended strongly, so it was that he would now become Cardinal Astral Zafan. Zafan declared that he would take a pilgrimage before resuming his cardinal duties. Nothing about that was unusual in the activities or the senior members of the ecclesiarchy. They would often consider it a necessity to travel the worlds within their sector to take the pulse of the populace and ensure that all shrines were adequately secure and attended. It had nothing to do with the fact that this also enshrined their status, power, and visibility in the hierarchy of power for the territory over which they presided. Cardinal Zafan's tour would take them to many shrines, cathedrals, and places of importance throughout this Scarus sector. He would preach upon these worlds, bring to the people the peace, security, and unity that the Imperial Creed provided. For it was his sacred duty now to protect the very souls of billions of Imperial citizens. By the standards of the ecclesiarchy, it was a modest tour. His entourage contained a mere 1,000 preachers, deacons, servants, and menials. It did, though, contain a personal bodyguard of the Adeptus Sororitas, as was pretty standard for such a powerful figure's pilgrimage. They were a gift from the Arcturus Priory of the Order of the Argent Shroud, and a cardinal may require protection from his flock just as much as he might against the more diabolical enemies of the Imperium. As was typical of such a tour, the presence of the cardinal and his entourage whipped the population of the world into a zealous frenzy. Such events were not commonplace, and so they raised the status and commitment to the Imperial faith significantly within the population. Often, this meant that the most zealous among the citizenry of a world would attach themselves to an ecclesiarchy pilgrimage if they were authorized to do so. And these may also be classed as redemptionists, but their presence can be as beneficial as it can be problematic. I've often noted that the quick-to-judge heretic stereotype among the Inquisition and ecclesiarchy is sometimes overstated, that in actuality such judgments are at least a little more measured. Well, not so among the Redemptionists. They may often in fact descend into the underhive of a city to purge traitors and heretics. And that means it's gonna happen one way or the other. Whether those that they find are truly heretics or not is not particularly relevant. And sometimes these overzealous worshippers require the intervention of the Arbites or even military forces to prevent them from whipping entire populations into crazed riots of senseless purging. For all their problems though, having some mad worshippers ready to throw themselves in harm's way at the slightest provocation is not always a bad thing for an imperial official, and so in the case of the Cardinal's pilgrimage, so long as the zealots were not actively causing a problem, they were tolerated. And as was also typical, they considered Cardinal Zafan's tour to be something of a crusade, whatever that meant in their eyes. Presumably some kind of opportunity to just purge heretics whenever they were encountered. When the Cardinal's pilgrimage reached the world of Thracian Primaris, Zafan's sermons attracted many thousands of its citizenry. Rioting sparked among the many thousands who were just attempting to see him with their own eyes, and the frustration simply boiled over. Arbites and Sororitas were forced to engage with the masses, and hundreds died in an ensuing slaughter. The Cardinal witnessed, for the first time then, something that began to shape their outlook. To understand that scores of these people could die, and still they would beg to join his service. For despite the many who lay dead at the hands of his bodyguards, just as many still lined up in the aftermath to pledge themselves personally to him. Some of the more extreme members of the populace were even calling him a messiah. Despite having spent his life around figures of power or religious faith and devotion, those who could command others essentially, he had never been so close as to actually feel that swelling glow of power that he now witnessed. For many among the ecclesiarchy and the imperial cult, this was something they understood all too well, and that had to be carefully managed, maybe used where appropriate, but always treated with a cautious respect. Zafan, though, began to see things a little differently. Upon his cardinal world, yes, there were duties to attend to, meetings, council debates, signing documents, authorizing whatever was placed in front of him by his attendants. This never felt like the true work he was needed for. Where was the real work? Where did the Emperor need him most? It was out here, on these worlds of the Imperium, just seeing how these people followed his words and his command, looking at what they could endure, and simply ask for more. It shaped his thinking, and that of his new position, in a way no scripture had. He did not want to be an all but anonymous cog in the bureaucracy of the Ministerium. Why waste the talents he saw were so self-evident? With his words alone, he could raise an army, he could do the real work that was required, seek out the heretics, purge those who threatened the Emperor's divine authority. And as is so often the case, those in power attract those who wish to bask in the diffuse glow of that power. The hangers-on, the close advisers who reaffirm every idea, good or bad. One of Cardinal Zafan's more key advisers would become Deacon Mammon. He had only recently joined the Cardinal's entourage during their time on Thracian Primaris, but he was already favoured by Zafan for his local knowledge and practical implementation of command. Most importantly, he agreed with Zafan that a uniting figure could certainly lead a war of faith throughout the Scarus sector, but that their next moves must be extremely carefully coordinated. Those who would seek to undermine such righteous efforts lay everywhere. The Ecclesiarchy was a carefully monitored faction within the Imperium for precisely these reasons. The Inquisition, the Administratum, the High Lords of Terran Mor all understood the risks that were attached to a member of the Ecclesiarchy sparking some kind of zealous crusade, often for no better reason than to simply see it happen in their name. The strict restrictions placed upon the religious leaders of the Imperium weren't without good reason. Cardinal Vandyre's infamous Reign of Blood had nearly fractured the Imperium, and none wished to see such turmoil again. For the consequences of such disorder occurring in M41 could be truly disastrous. The Ordo Hereticus of the Inquisition, the general spies and informants of the Imperial bureaucracy, for this reason, were everywhere, and especially on worlds of religious significance, not to mention the cardinal world. So it went without saying that within his entourage, as it stood, there were likely already those who had penetrated and installed themselves so as to be able to learn of the current agenda, monitor the thoughts and the wishes of the cardinal and his close representatives, and report back as to any concerning matters. So Zafan agreed with Mammon that to proceed further, they needed two actions. The first was to tighten his group of advisors to a small number of vetted and indisputably loyal members. The second was to find a world that they could plausibly travel to and spend time upon, but that was unassuming enough, it would be very unlikely to contain already agents who may work against their plans. They needed somewhere with seclusion, that could be a quiet place to plan and begin this war of faith, knowing that once it was underway, the sheer momentum alone would very likely make it unstoppable, and they could rationalize this later. Deacon Mammon would choose Vrax as the site to seclude themselves, for it was perfect for their needs. A plausible site to tour with its shrine to St. Leonis, and very conveniently, an Imperial armory. Vrax was to become his residence for the foreseeable future. Zafan's arrival was a repetition of those that had come before, officials presenting themselves at the starport, throngs of fanatical pilgrims, a procession of his entourage. And here, of course, is where we pick up the story. Zafan enters his period of isolation from public view. The daily activities of Vrax continued on pretty much as they always had. Pilgrims, indentured workers, Imperial Guard re-equips. Those who had accompanied the Cardinal also took up residence. The Sororitas of the Argent Shroud made themselves at home in the priory adjacent to the Cardinal's palace estate. Deacon Mammon began to set the wheels in motion for what they required next. It was very much to their benefit that they already had a loyal base of followers, this they knew. But how to raise them into a force they could wield? Although there were the restrictions for the Cardinal or any ministerium high up to raise a militia force, the Shrine of St. Leonis could be used as leverage to circumvent this problem. Although there was a flat ruling against raising any kind of standing army, a holy site could, in times where it was threatened, raise a fraternis militia to protect itself. It's not uncommon that in the Imperium, citizens upon a world hear about a conflict that's coming or something happening off-world rather than ever actually see it with their own eyes. Sometimes such conflicts can continue on for centuries, the war on the fringe of a system to which the guard and militiamen are continually shipped off to. But that war may never actually come to the Hive City itself, and that's for the benefit of everybody. So upon Vrax, rumours began to spread. Missionaries and preachers began to infiltrate and inject a narrative into the populace of Vrax. Systems in the region were under attack from heretics, and that Vrax itself could be next. The mere prospect of this activated the religious pilgrims, and of course the zealots among the Cardinal's existing followers, who were by now breathlessly waiting for just such an eventuality. Almost immediately upon Vrax, the mood changed, and any who spoke even the mildest criticisms towards Zafan were detained or worse. So it wouldn't be too strong to suggest that almost from the outset, Zafan and Mammon had created their very own cult upon Vrax, for the behaviour of the mob immediately became fitting of such a description. Cardinal Zafan would protect them, protect St. Leonis, and indeed Vrax itself. He was their saviour, his words were the only truth they needed, and only with their complete loyalty and devotion could all endure the conflagration that was likely coming. Meanwhile, as all this furious activity was taking place in public, Deacon Mammon was also forming the Inner Circle retinue that they had planned, drawn from the Frateris who had sworn oaths to the Cardinal during their tour so far, or from the pilgrims already upon Vrax. These would become the Disciples of Zaphan, and represent an elite force to protect him at all times. Most shockingly, the commanders of the Vrax garrison, the steward of the citadel itself, were coerced and bribed into compliance. Soon enough, they were loyal members to the Cardinal also. And then there were of course those who resisted. But with the momentum already swelling upon Vrax in the populace, any officials who would not kiss the ring of Zaphan would be replaced with hardened loyalists of the Cardinal. In doing so, Zaphan and Mammon had cleverly sidestepped the restrictions placed upon them. They were not directly commanding any military force here on Vrax, so to speak, but those who did command the forces were under the full influence of the Cardinal and his closest advisers. And this prostration of the regular forces before Zaphan was vital to their plans. For while the small militia raised around the charade of protecting the shrine served its purpose, such a force would never be able to hold out against any real opposition. The only holdouts upon Vrax would remain the Arbites. Mammon had of course been correct. Although he and the Cardinal thought they had been very subtle, very careful, the eyes of the Inquisition and other Imperial administrative forces are everywhere. And while they had chosen a planet which served their purposes, even such a quiet world as Vrax had agents upon it. It was in many ways a very foolish wish by Zaphan and Mammon to imagine that they could begin such an uprising and have nobody notice. Vrax, just like many worlds, had a populace primed to resist the cruelty of the Imperium. Its population of millions did not live a particularly good life. Labour gangs, underground workers in the stockpile warehouses and vaults, masses of indentured workers often chained together to perform laborious, repetitive tasks. So no one would be shocked that a visiting cardinal now making his home upon their world would fuel those who had nothing with the energy of hope, and that maybe the Emperor's light finally would shine upon them. They believed it, and why wouldn't they? Agents and those who had infiltrated the followers of the Cardinal reported all of this to the Ordo Hereticus. And almost immediately a decision was made. The reign of Cardinal Zaphan was to be ended. Such situations are the scenarios ideally suited to the members of the Officio Assassinorum, because to detain somebody like Zaphan would now be likely impossible and inflammatory. They may even see some pushback from the broader ecclesiarchy. And although an assassination was not a particularly better option, it would likely be generally a cleaner solution. Yes, in the short-term aftermath, certainly tempers would flare, but often these will burn out quite quickly. Other officials are also reminded of the fact that the power of the Imperium cannot be ignored nor hidden from. Ordinary citizenry may riot for a time, but eventually this burns itself out. The priority was to remove the head of the snake. When the single shot heavy penetrator round from a Vindicare assassin's rifle rang out, it was the last thing that the Cardinal and those around him could have expected. A stone pillar exploded, and although it punched clean through the stone, the impact still reduced its energy. A bright flash of light blinded those immediately surrounding Cardinal Zaphan as the round struck its target. Unfortunately for the assassin, Zaphan was wearing a Rosarius-mounted refractor that, to the untrained eye, was merely a decorative item. However, these are in fact powerful personal force fields, commonly seen used by Astartes chaplains or any Imperial figures of authority, and they're designed to guard against just such an assassination attempt. But before he could even clamber to his feet, the personal guards immediately surrounding him were instantly dead as more shots came. But the most important shot had failed. The assassin knew that their primary objective was no longer viable, and the immediate situation was about to quickly deteriorate. He reloaded with lightning precision and descended at speed a spiral staircase into the chaotic, panicked courtyards below. The scene was reminiscent of having kicked apart an ant's nest. Pilgrims and guards were in an apoplectic state of shock and disbelief, and the assassin burst through an arched door at the bottom of the stairwell. He came face to face with a young preacher who simply stared in stunned silence at the black-clad monster before him. What was this thing? Before he had an opportunity to scream or even formulate a thought, he was instantly slaughtered by the Vindicare, his chest exploding from the hip-fired near-point-blank rifle shot. Guards were everywhere now, and all doors in and out of the citadel were being sealed. Stealth was no longer an option, as the assassin made for any escape that could be found. They deactivated and discarded their rifle as its bulk was no longer optimal. Evasion and escape was the absolute priority. The Vindicare was moving so fast as to be a blur to ordinary human vision. Of the guards who made feeble attempts to engage the assassin, many were soon bleeding out. As the assassin continued to flee, it fired off more precision shots from its aptly named Exodus pistol. But all escape solutions were blocked, or too heavily guarded, for even the assassin to make a successful assault upon. In what was surely something approaching what may have qualified as panic, the Vindicare found themselves heading into the crypts of the Basilica. Perhaps here there could be some kind of exit, or at least an opportunity to conceal themselves. Instead, what they found was a literal dead end. A mass of guard were rushing down, grenades already being thrown ahead of them, down the stone stairs in saturation levels. Massive levels of concussion, smoke and dust filled the chamber. The assassin opened fire on the first wave of guards, who were slaughtered with ease. But finally, the assassin was pinned to the wall by fire from wave after wave of zealous, enraged citadel guards. The assassin's shredded remains were dragged out to then be paraded before the faithful. And far from being the action that would release the world from the grip of the cardinal, the assassin, through their failure, had condemned the world of Vrax for what was to come. Entirely expectedly, Zafan would use this event as proof of both his divinity having survived an assassination attempt, but also to confirm the rumours that they had been spreading already, that the real enemy were those who would seek to unseat the cardinal and his most ardent loyalists, and here now was the proof. The fate of the world was sealed. Militia ran to arm themselves. Looters plundered weapons and ammunition in vast quantities, fighting amongst one another as they carried away more than they knew even what to do with. The Arbites made very limited attempts to control the situation, but were ultimately crushed under the weight of rampaging fanatics. Cardinal Astral Zafan and Deacon Mammon had no need to hesitate any further. They immediately moved to take control of Vrax and all its material assets. Hundreds of thousands of labourers and other workers broke free from their guards and also rushed to equip themselves with whatever weapons they could find. This was their moment. Something approaching civil war consumed Vrax in the coming days. No loyalists would be spared. The confused Sororitas attempted to appeal to Cardinal Zafan, imagining that they would somehow be able to resolve this situation. Instead, they found themselves disarmed and imprisoned in the deepest dungeons of Vrax. They would not see the light of day again for many, many years. Administratum bastions were stormed, the Master Prefect was killed attempting to escape the planet, and any remaining guard who did not pledge their obedience or surrender to the Disciples of Zafan were executed on the spot. The communication networks and astropathic array were overrun, as the world of Vrax now went silent. Cardinal Astral Zafan now held singular and total control over the citadel of Vrax. The timing, though, was problematic. It was clear that the Imperium were set upon removing Zafan from his position, and the shockingly brazen assassination attempt came far sooner than they ever could have imagined. They had barely begun to prepare for their crusade, their war of faith that would elevate the status and power of the cardinal. And now what could they do? They could not proceed with this. And so they had to instead turn to consider their very survival. They needed to begin preparations for a defence immediately. For the only question upon their minds now was who would the Imperium send to wrest back control of Vrax in the name of the God Emperor of mankind. Confirmation of just what had taken place upon Vrax took some time. The Ordo Hereticus was obviously not in communication with the Departamento Munitorum, nor were they about to volunteer the fact that a cardinal of the Ecclesiarchy had been designated a target for assassination, which had then failed. The wheels of Imperial bureaucracy turn excruciatingly slowly, no doubt something that the Deacon and Cardinal had been entirely prepared to rely upon, knowing full well whatever response came would not be swift, but it may indeed be severe. Many months passed before the Administratum on Terra even began to prepare any kind of response preparation. Vrax was a fairly low priority in the greater scheme of things. It was not a vast population centre containing tens or hundreds of billions of citizens in hive worlds. It was not a key Mechanicus Forge world, nor was it a critically placed world in an active border war zone. It was logistically important for the Munitorum, although in the present moment, Vrax seemed unimportant even in this regard. The forces of Chaos, though, were unpredictable, and raids, or worse, a new Black Crusade, could appear anywhere at any time, with little, if any, time in which to prepare. In such a scenario, a world such as Vrax was vital. It could determine the fate of a vast region within a spatial sector. The Emperor's Tarot told an equally bleak story. All the predictions were doom-laden, and so it seemed entirely likely that given its proximity to the Eye of Terra, if the dark forces within learned of the situation upon Vrax, they would try to exploit it. This could then lead to a new staging point to launch a far more serious campaign upon other Imperial systems. So it was entirely clear that the situation could not be allowed to fester, or far worse, spread. A suitable deployment to regain control of the planet then became a foregone conclusion. Although the bureaucracy of the Imperium does move slowly, it also, like the Inquisition, will view things with a far broader lens than is measured by the individual lifespan of a citizen upon a world. Vrax may not be important now, but in 10, 20, 50, 100 years, it could be vital. So for however long it would take to regain control of the planet was considered pretty acceptable. Yet the planet did not rise to a level of priority that would require, say, the involvement of an Astartes chapter. The situation as it stood was quite muted. So that meant this was a matter for the Imperial Guard. The High Command of Segmentum Obscurus were issued orders to retake Vrax in the name of the Emperor. The commanders stationed upon Cadia read the briefings, the intelligence, and the documentation of Vrax defensive capabilities in this mission they had been tasked with, and it made for sobering reading. Vrax was no hive world, no Xenos jumping off point. It did not contain a multi-purpose, sparse industrial sprawl, nor a solid mix of habitation and fabrication which saw both strong and weak points which could be exploited. Vrax was, to put it simply, a rock. Vrax had been designed to withstand extended assaults, and its citadel was deemed near unbreakable. The senior members of the Astra Militarum began to feel quite uneasy with what they had to face. Within their calculations, there was a solid argument that the expenditure of men and materials required to retake the planet would be so severe that it would bring about a net loss when all was said and done. On that basis, there was a logical argument for straight exterminatus. They then could always rebuild and re-equip the planet later. At least this would enable them to quickly garrison a force with the same material required to, on paper, retake the world. And likely this could occur in a shorter time frame as well. The more sceptical members of the High Command also highlighted that with any long-term engagement, there would be unforeseen dangers, random events, and who could predict what else. So might it be better to just draw a line under the situation and move forward? All of these pleas carried very little weight, because the order from Terra itself was not to burn the planet and rebuild. The order was to retake the world of Vrax. It was marked with the seal of a prefect of the Master Administratum's office, servants directly working under command of the High Lords of Terra. Their hands were tied. Failure to carry out the order would be met with unthinkable repercussions by the Inquisition. And so the Militarum shelved all other options. The Lord Castellan began, alongside his Imperial commanders, to draw up their plans for the siege of Vrax. Regardless of how successful or long it may be, the assault upon Vrax was now confirmed. It rested with the Council Poncadia to decide just what form this would take. And given the concerning information they had before them about the Citadel on Vrax and its ground-to-orbit defensive capabilities, several options were immediately discounted. Orbital assaults could not conquer worlds. At some stage, deployment would be necessary, and likely any ships attempting to engage from orbit would suffer considerable losses. Landing craft would be incinerated from the skies by the defensive laser batteries. Astartes drop pods would also be of limited use in such a defensive position, and they themselves would also risk considerable losses from defensive laser batteries. Their Thunderhawk gunships wouldn't fare much better. Overall, the conclusion was that any direct high-intensity assault, be that Guard or Astartes, would suffer significant losses, and they may not even be particularly effective. Were they to request the Astartes to be involved, any chapter master would look at what they faced and understand the number of battle brothers required to make a dent in the defences of Vrax were just a poor use of their abilities, and ultimately would be damaging to other conflicts where they would be best deployed. These were no longer the days of the Great Crusade and the Legions. Astartes now operated more like strike teams. In some instances, they took on supporting command roles for a world. So if they were to take part in a protracted siege war, this occurred only for the most strategically paramount worlds, such as Cadia itself, or as we looked at recently, Vigilus. One suggestion that did gain some support was for a naval blockade of the world. It was not a great solution, but it had its advantages in terms of minimizing material loss. They would prevent reinforcements and supplies, periodically launch unexpected raids against its defenses with hard-hitting, well-equipped, smaller teams. And then perhaps over a century, they could diminish the strength of the Citadel enough that a more direct assault with some losses would then be practical, and they believed this could be achieved fairly sustainably. Some among the military council noted that a period of 500 years for such a plan was more realistic, and that the Munitorum would just reject this outright for being too weak-willed and dragged over a scale of time that they would see as unacceptable. The last option then was a protracted siege battle. It was certainly as unpalatable as the second option, but it had the benefit of maintaining constant pressure upon the enemy. After all, these were not veteran guardsmen. It was a garrison force supported by militia, and effectively a peasant revolt. Who knew how long they would last against the pressures of Imperial siege warfare? They would grind them down through long-range artillery and trench warfare, month after month, year after year, until they were completely broken. After all calculations were complete, attrition rates, resupply practicalities, the unpredictability of warp travel, the number they settled upon was 12. 12 years to complete the siege of Vrax. Their solution was sent on to the Departmentum Munitorum. A new army were to be founded to lay waste to the traitors held up in their bastion citadel upon Vrax. The force assigned to this task, the 88th Imperial Guard Siege Army. All of its number were to be drawn from the planet of Krieg. It would comprise some 18 of their siege infantry regiments, 5 tank regiments, 8 artillery regiments, and then additional independent artillery containing 10 artillery and 4 heavy mortar companies. Now, I have already covered the origins of the Death Corps of Krieg in a separate video on screen now, so follow that link if you wish to have that additional information, which I recommend as it's very relevant. In short though, the Death Corps of Krieg are an anomaly within the Imperial Guard. The world they originate from was effectively completely destroyed in a 500-year civil war that culminated in nuclear Armageddon. The Imperium effectively wrote off the world as dead, only to discover some time later, and to their shock, that some had endured below ground. The surface of the world was now an irradiated hinterland, the planet tracked with hundreds if not thousands of miles of trench networks, and those who had continued the war above ground, known now as the Death Corps. Over 15 generations, the Death Corps had been tempered in the ashen hell of their world, and learned how to exist in the most extreme warfare conditions imaginable. Where others' morale would break, the Krieg had become, through the nightmare of their own world's experience, conditioned to weather any scenario, for little could compare to the psychological horror they had endured upon Krieg. Where other Imperial Guard forces were bolstered by rousing speeches and the achievements of individuals, the progression of rank, the hope of survival, the Kriegsmen took a fairly unique perspective. They accepted their losses, totally. The scale of loss was never a relevant factor for them, only that in some small respect, their life counted toward the overall goal. For many other Imperial Guard forces, fighting alongside the Death Corps was a disturbing experience. For one, they appeared entirely anonymous, referring to one another only by their identity numbers. Rarely did they ever remove their respirator masks, and most troubling of all, showing an almost casual disregard for life. In some instances, the deployment of Krieg alongside regular guard forces actually had a demoralizing effect, and commissars were often assigned to attempt to reduce the horrifying waste of life being displayed before others, often with only limited success. For these reasons, along with the fact that those from Krieg excelled in specifically the kind of warfare that was required on Vrax, the Death Corps were chosen. They were the masters of material attrition and could endure the horror that was to come. Such a war would have broken any regular guardsman in a matter of months. Those of the Death Corps of Krieg could endure, weather, the unrelenting bombardments, the assaults across open ground that could see as high as 99% losses. I've often seen it said that the Siege of Vrax is regarded as the stereotypical gone-wrong military campaign, the everything was doomed from the start and we will glorify the depressing horror of the situation. Now in some respects, that's not untrue, but in the main respect, it's completely wrong. The deployment of the Death Corps to Vrax was not intentioned to be a war that would be easily won. It was never intentioned to be a war where losses could be minimized or some clever strategic ploy made to move things forward more quickly. The Imperium, the Munitorum, the Guard commanders knew exactly what they would see upon Vrax. So this was not a mistake. It was not an error of judgment or poor planning. They had calculated everything before they began the deployment of siege forces to Vrax. They expected to see a horrifying war of attrition that would last easily beyond a decade. They expected a high rate of material losses and a trench war of appalling human wastage. This was not a surgical strike, it was a blunt trauma campaign of how many lives will it take to regain control. So there was no confusion whatsoever in what the commanders were asking, and the siege upon Vrax was to unfold just as they had expected, at least in the initial years. Every part of the 88th Siege Army had been designed as being expendable. The coming deployment was almost a mathematical formula more than it was a strategy. And this is something even the Krieg understand themselves. For the Krieg view themselves not as individuals, but as a collective force. This is why they do not indulge in individual names, why they rarely remove their respirator masks. Anonymity is key to their effectiveness, to maintaining their discipline, their anti-morale. If a position 50 yards ahead must be taken, and to take that requires 1,000 lives, that is the number that is required to take that position. Their deployments will be calculated on this basis, Where were the most lives needed to achieve such and such an objective? Their lives mattered no more than did the counting of artillery shells, the rations required to sustain them, or the fuel consumption of armoured companies. The Death Corps of Krieg are human, but they are also dehumanised. This is entirely by design. And rumours persist about the very nature of Krieg soldiers. Many are suspicious of their concealed faces. Some have speculated that they replenish their vast numbers a little too quickly. The use of ancient tech to bring new soldiers to the field has never been confirmed, and the Krieg are known to not look all alike. But some among the biologists question if this is not a case of literal cloning, then certainly there is a level of genetic tampering which exists within those who hail from the death world of Krieg. In the time since that fateful shot rang out, Cardinal Zafan and the Deacon Mammon had established a new power structure. It was a fairly typical authoritarian playbook. Those who proved loyalty and were aggressively successful in their role were given promotion and power. Zafan and Mammon cared little about how that was achieved, only that those who were closest to them were loyal in the absolute and self-disciplined, willfully strong individuals. Their approach was to be fairly simplistic. They had plenty of material firepower, and the masses upon the world were reminded that just as the approaching enemy would show them no mercy, neither should they be given any. For if they could just hold this world and be successful, the rewards to all would be great, and the message sent even greater. The existing garrison may have been able to give something approaching the most rudimentary of training, but this was not a planet stacked with veteran guard regiments. However, they likely could stand and fire weapons, and that was about all that was really required here. The trench networks surrounding the citadel were extended and reinforced. Artillery was brought out from storage en masse and positioned with a catalogue of pre-ranged positions to fire upon. Cardinal Zafan wished to see a scene upon the wastelands of Vrax that was nothing less than, in his words, a slaughterhouse. The sheer numbers were a major strength for the forces of Zafan. An unknown number, but something estimated at that 8 million souls. All of them were now considered, activated, and potential combatants. Within their number were the disciples of Zafan, who likely formed something approaching the standard Imperial Guard soldier. They were the most experienced, well-equipped, and most zealous, and would be also the core of their army. Second were the standing garrison force here, the PDF, pretty poorly trained but mostly competent. And beyond that were the workers, who were given training where possible, but mostly were driven by a bitter resentment and just a desire to live. They were incapable of using any complex equipment like artillery or armour, but they could be thrown at the enemy in big numbers or stood at defensive positions to fire from, but in truth their numbers counted considerably more than their combat effectiveness. Adjacent to these were the pilgrims and worshippers. They were as effective as the workforce in terms of their combat experience and ability, but they were driven by a holy fire within them, a desire to protect the shrine of the saint and the cardinal. In many respects, this potentially made them more dangerous than the workforce militia, as the zealots tend to be far more ferocious and harder to break in terms of morale. Herding the flock of Zafan were his preachers and other trusted officials. They would act in the role of something approaching commissars to remind all of why they should do their duty, and that failure to do so would be considered an act of treachery that must be met with, unsurprisingly, their deaths. Had they not been stationed within a heavily reinforced bastion citadel with massive armament stockpiles, it's unlikely they would have been able to present any kind of effective resistance. As it was, they had everything they needed to withstand a considerable counter-offensive, and they were quietly confident. Unfortunately for the traitors, they could not begin to imagine the scale of deployment that was about to approach the world. There is, though, one important detail to additionally bear in mind. While it is of course true that the Death Corps of Krieg have a terrifying, well-earned reputation for being unbreakable and experts in siege war, who train tirelessly upon their own world in unending live-fire mock battles amid the irradiated wastelands of their planet, something that I often think is forgotten when it comes to the Krieg forces is the reality of what their apathetic wars of attrition mean for those who fight in the uniform. The soldiers of Krieg are well known for suffering those absurd rates of loss, and while they may be as well trained as any soldier could be, perhaps more so in terms of the Imperium, they're also unable to field any decent numbers of veterans, for the fairly obvious reason that few Krieg live long enough to become veterans. So for the soldiers approaching the world of Vrax, they may have looked very intimidating with their heavy battle coats, respirator masks, their historical regimental numbers, each with a very interesting story behind it. But the majority of those soldiers were entirely untested in battle. Now, to be clear, this is not to suggest that the soldiers of Krieg are in any way poorly trained or otherwise becoming compromised. They have a set method in which they wage war, and it works very well. And their training is far beyond the standard Imperial soldier. Most are indoctrinated into the life of war almost from birth. Fear and weaknesses are not tolerated, and many will have been psychologically broken and rebuilt many times during their training. They are designed to withstand environmental, chemical, physical factors that would cause even trained guardsmen to break. And this is before they are tested in the ultimate battle zone, that hellish nightmare, which is the surface of Krieg itself. But nonetheless, all of these strengths do not equate to real experience in the field, and this is something that some would argue is a weak point in the Krieg ideology and battle strategy. Something that is perhaps more successful seen in other regiments, maybe the equally hardened, disciplined guardsmen of Mordian. But a key difference being, Mordians will not expend their lives at the earliest opportunity. They will do so, if necessary, but they will also retreat to regroup and fight another day. This is not idle speculation. In the historical accounts of Krieg wars, they are often in desperate need of men who could be promoted to the officer ranks. Most Krieg soldiers do not wish, though, to be away from the front lines of battle. They actively resist promotion, nor do many survive to become veterans, and of those that do, even less of those would then survive long enough to carry out actions or strategies of significant noteworthiness that it would qualify them to gain field promotion. And then comically, of those who do, the Krieg structure dictates that officers should fight alongside of those that they command, for no individual in the Krieg armies should be valued more than another, so they then inevitably lose quite a lot of officers as well. I think of it similarly to the Primaris Marines in some respects. The Primaris Marines, the Ultima founding, emerged having spent millennia in the production facilities of Belisarius Corps, and they were mentally and physically primed to be the ultimate warriors for the Imperium. Yet of those among that founding, those who were gifted then to Astartes chapters, not upgraded firstborn Marines, it became evident that for as strong as they were also lacking. Let's call it real-world experience. Because for good reason, many of these new Primaris Marines were mixed in with firstborn Astartes, who would help to mentor them and give them their centuries of battle experience. And that is a similar problem for the Krieg. Hardened fighters? Yes. Born upon the most hellish of death worlds? Also yes. Trained and tested against the most apocalyptic conditions with zero tolerance for any who do not meet the expected standards? Yes. Tested in real battle conditions? No. Now, as I said, to be clear, they do also field veteran units. These are usually any of the more specialized forces in the Krieg, but most commonly they are assigned to the Grenadier units. Veteran, though, might be a stretch compared to what qualifies that term among other Guard regiments, because Krieg veterans tend to be just the survivors of their originally decimated squads. They form the role then of heavy infantry, and how are these veterans best deployed against the enemy? Well, of course, they form the leading edge of an assault wave, the first men to go in. the theory being that their heavy equipment and experience will sharpen the edge of an assault and cut deeper into an enemy, armed with las weapons designated as hell guns, a turbo discharge weapon linked to a high capacity energy cell worn on the back, essentially hotshot las guns, and they also can be equipped with just about any combination of infantry weaponry they choose. They are, in effect, the Krieg iteration of Imperial Stormtroopers. They may also be seen to use these small armoured vehicles known as Centaur Carriers, which would propel them forward across the lines, also enabling them to bring any heavy weaponry they should need in tow, heavy flamers, stubbers, and so on. So the potential lethality of the Grenadier Corps is far from being an incorrect assumption, but it's just comical that again they throw any who survive even a little longer than average into a role with the lowest possible chance of survival. Not that this would in any way impact their combat effectiveness, as most Krieg, including those of the Grenadiers, consider themselves effectively martyred already in the name of the Emperor from the day they're deployed. Now, although the size of force calculated to complete the mission upon Vrax was considerable, what could not be ignored were the problems facing them in the deployment. The orbital weapons held by the Citadel negated any possibility of a localized deployment, and so the Imperial forces would have to land their regiments, armor as well, and supplies, all materials required to carry out the campaign, on the far side of the world. They would then have to form a secure, reinforced landing site before any march toward the enemy could begin. And Vrax was a world that could be described as featureless. Its system was not noteworthy, and only its galactic position warranted this world to be used as anything at all, and ultimately all that it really suited was an armory for the Munitorum. The planet was a barren wasteland, bare rock, electrical storms, volcanic activity, and this meant the open desert-like environment was covered in sulfurous ash, which then happily would turn into a sludge-like quagmire as storms passed through. The areas surrounding the Citadel were designated the Van Meersland Wastes, and this would be the area to which the Krieg must travel to begin the long war ahead, for victory would come at any price. Command of the operation was given to Lord Commander Zhulka, a figure who is something of a military trope, but nothing out of the ordinary for the Imperium of Mankind and the Astra Militarum. A man who found himself in a position of power and influence through the strings pulled by his family rather than any actual achievements to merit the assignment. His great-grandfather, though, had served as an attaché to the Lord Solar on Terra, and as is often the case within the Imperium, people cling desperately upon any claims to historical power. So having someone effectively unqualified head up a major assault may seem absurd, unbelievable even. Except, is it? Is it really? This is the Imperium of Mankind we're talking about, who literally wage wars based on numerical superiority and little more. A galactic empire of corruption and manipulation, and which falls victim to the very worst traits of human self-aggrandizement. Zhulka had established his headquarters during the deployment zone of the first Krieg to arrive on the planet. This would enable him to see in real time the progress of the Imperial forces and make adjustments as necessary to the changing situation on the ground. No, just kidding, he wasn't even in orbit of the planet. He set up his HQ on another planet entirely that was more than safe and at a considerable distance away from Vrax.
If you should falter, remember that Captain Darling and I are behind you.
About 35 miles behind.
The view was that his personal presence as commander was not needed upon Vrax itself. The siege army would largely follow the order of battle without requiring excessive command input. He stationed himself upon Thracian Primaris, a key world in the Scarus sector, and critically, very, very safe compared to an active siege upon a world. As far as Zhulka was concerned, periodic updates and signed orders to send reinforcements were just about all he was really required to do to perform his duties. But the beginning deployment of this was very successful. The defending traitors had no naval assets and so could not engage with the Imperials in any way. They were also not about to trek halfway across the world to engage as the landing took place. So the Krieg forces could land in fairly relaxed, organised fashion. It suddenly benefited them in terms of reducing loss, for having to establish a landing zone for such a huge bulk of forces whilst under fire would certainly have been suboptimal. The first Kree to land would then begin establishing trenches and defensive positions, with engineers and excavators digging in against any possibility of a response. Kree Death Riders patrolled the most distant perimeter of their landing zone, and minefields were even set up to guard against any possible armoured scouting parties. The build-up of men and materials continued without any pause, and there was no sign of any defending enemy that would interfere with this. The situation remained the same for many months, and it was highly beneficial for the 88th, as they were able to well organise the astonishing scale of men and armour being deployed and moved toward the Citadel. It took almost a year fully to deploy all required resources and move them toward their starting positions. And to achieve this, in addition to the 88th Siege Army itself, the Munitorum had deployed a 500,000 strong labour force, largely consisting of penal workers. They had landed their force in all but complete safety, never seeing any shots fired by the distant traitors. Yet the issue that faced them now was having to move all of that equipment and manpower well over 1,000 miles. To march them or drive the armour that far made very little logistical sense, not to mention the fact that they were not expecting significant harassment or threat from the enemy in the majority of that distance. Instead, the Penal Labour Corps were to construct a railway. This would then transport the men and materials to the frontline staging area. Although extremely time-consuming, there was a logistical benefit, because they knew ahead of time that continual reinforcements and resupplies would be very necessary for this campaign, and the threat of the orbital lasers mounted around the Citadel were not going away anytime soon. So the railway was a long-term investment that in theory would allow safe delivery of resupplies where the defending enemy would not receive any, and that would, on paper, factor into any eventual victory. So the railway would terminate a relatively safe 100-mile distance from the front lines. Here would be the well-separated stockpiles of fuel, ammunition, and so on. And this staging area would then require the Krieg themselves to reach the front under their own power. The plan for the 88th in the early stages of the campaign would be fairly straightforward. Reduce the enemy defences, weather them down, and in time, an opportunity to capture the Citadel would likely present itself. But their void shields prevented any meaningful assault upon the fortress as it stood currently, and in order to do this, they would eventually need to bleed the enemy as hard and for as long as possible. Void shields are, of course, extremely powerful. They're the shielding used by the Titanic war machines, but they can be collapsed when placed under significant enough firing pressure from just about any weaponry. So the long-term plan for the 88th Siege Army was to apply continual and unrelenting pressure on all sides of the defenders' positions. Then, after many years of constant attrition and pressure, a massive assault to bring down their shields and capture the Citadel. Easier said than done, but theoretically plausible. Unfortunately for the Krieg, those who had chosen the position upon Vrax for the Citadel had chosen very well. Environmental features of the planet, namely canyons and deep gorges to the south and the east, prevented any kind of comprehensive encircling of the Citadel. Only the open region to the north and west of the city were viable to engage in, and these were the areas that were unsurprisingly most heavily defended. This also meant, unfortunately, that the enemy did not have to thinly distribute their forces all around, but would be able to continually reinforce and replenish their losses in a concentrated area. So the opening engagements would have to be steady, measured, and most of all, well supported. Krieg regiments were not known for lightning raids or striking breaks through enemy lines. They made steady, supported forward attacks on enemy lines, gaining ground bit by bit. They would have well-communicated coordination to prevent themselves being outflanked or overstretched, and they were always very wary of counterattacks that could make any kind of forward assault counterproductive. After they had made progress to the north and west of the enemy lines, they would then be able to progress forward to the second major defensive lines, and from here, with some luck, begin toward something approaching a true encirclement of the enemy. Essentially, it boiled down to hit the outer defensive lines of the enemy as hard as possible, overwhelm them, push in, close the circle, and then make more cautious engagements. Dig in, weather them down, exploit weaknesses where possible, and tighten the cordon around the citadel, until it would eventually be clear that there was no escape to be had, and a killing blow could be delivered. The defenders had reached a point of wondering if an assault would ever come. They had spent months, and in some cases years, in the trench lines surrounding the citadel. One day blurred into another, and a day into a week into a month. It was cold. Their lines were poorly maintained. It was a miserable duty staring into the nothingness of the Van Meersland wastes. Yet they knew that it would come, and they had felt a strange electricity in the air of late, that something was coming, and coming soon. The traitors were correct, for they were being observed themselves. To the west, as the grey dawn upon Vrax shimmered its bleak, pale sunlight, Krieg artillery positions were watching through rangefinders and scanners. They were in position. They were prepared. This was to be the day it all began. Gun crews stood ready, massive Earthshaker artillery barrels pointed skyward, and everywhere surrounding them were shells, massive shells, piled high enough to sustain the artillery positions for the truly massive bombardments in the opening engagement of the long war to come. A Vox Combox crackled into life. High-pitched beeping screamed through the speaker, and the communications operator flicked switches to descramble the message, each turning to their commander. "Signal is correct, sir. Open fire." The Krieg gunners and artillery crews braced themselves for the onslaught that had been over a year in preparation, and that would not end until the traitors lay obliterated, pounded into dust from the immense siege weaponry of the Death Corps. They received the order through their helmet communicators. All eyes were locked upon their commanders, who, as they dropped their arm, screamed out, "Open fire!" The siege of Vrax had begun.